Penguin Audiobooks presents John Paul the Great by Peggy Noonan. Read by the author.
Chapter 1. I Saw a Saint at Sunset. It was early morning in the Vatican, July 2, 2003, a brilliant morning in the middle of the worst Roman heat wave in a century. The city was quiet, the streets soft with the heat. It was the summer of the dress code battle between the tourists and the guards at St. Peter's Basilica. The tourists wanted to wear shorts and halter tops, which was in violation of the Vatican dress code. The guards wouldn't let them in. There were arguments at the entrance of the basilica and angry words. But soon a Roman compromise was achieved. No one lost face. Everyone got what they needed. The vendors in St. Peter's Square were allowed to sell paper shirts and pants for €1 apiece. The tourists would put them on over their clothes, kind of grumblingly, and walk past the guards and tear the paper off as they entered the dark cool of the church. By 7:45 a.m., hundreds of us had gathered in the Piazza del Sant'Uffizio, in the shadow of Bernini's colonnade, the marble columns that curve outward to embrace St. Peter's Square. Already the heat was gathering, and we started to fan ourselves with thin green papal audience tickets. The crowd was very happy, chirping nuns and clicking tourists. We were about to see the Pope. We were a mix of people, the curious, the faithful. A group of deaf Italian adults in white baseball caps over here. They had silk Vatican flags tied around their necks. Over there were members of a choir from the Archdiocese of St. Louis, Missouri. There was a group of nuns from the Little Mission for the Deaf in Bologna. There was a man from Monterrey, Mexico, with his wife and two children. As the crowd grew, we were pressed so close I could smell the spray starch on his green cotton shirt. I said, "Why are you here?" He said, "To see the Pope." He said, "He is the most important Christian in the world. He is the follower of Christ." When, a few minutes later, I read the quote back to him from my notebook, he edited it. He said, "No, he is the most important person in the whole world." I talked to one woman, an extraordinary-looking woman in a hat made of hay. It was spiky yellow straw, actually, and the brim was down to shade her face. She was 45 or 50 years old, and she looked like the pictures of the older, weathered Greta Garbo. She told me she was on a pilgrimage. She had walked hundreds of kilometers in a circuitous tour of Marian sites. She and her husband, he was the bearish, gray-bearded fellow over there, they had departed Upper Austria in May, and they had arrived here in Rome yesterday, July 1st. They had walked on highways and small roads. She was very eager to show me her diary of the pilgrimage. In neat, precise script, she had documented every church they had seen along the way, and her husband, next to the words, had drawn pictures of cathedrals in blue ballpoint ink. He'd taken a lot of snapshots of little chapels and pasted them in the diary. She said to me, "Here, look," and she indicated a page on which she had made comic line drawings. They showed angular feet bruised by exaggerated calluses and blisters. Next to them, she had drawn the lotions and bandages she had put upon her wounds. They'd gone to Mass every day of their 6-week journey, she said. I said to her, "Why did you come here?" And she was surprised. She said, "Why?" "To see Il Papa." And she gestured as if to say, "This is the culmination." We filed through metal detectors that did not seem to work, no beeping or bopping, no one watching things really closely. It is surprising to see metal detectors here at a place like this for a crowd like this. But the last time someone planned to kill the Pope, in the Philippines, the would-be assassin had meant to dress as a priest. Soon we were directed through a paved area just off St. Peter's Square. Later, when I would return to it, a young priest would tell me, "We think he may have been crucified under here." I shook my head, not understanding. He said, St. Peter, it may have been just about here, down there. And he pointed down at the pavement. We entered the Paul VI Audience Hall, an enormous concrete structure, cavernous and modern. It was like a big suburban church or an evangelical McChurch at the edge of a city. Rows of fixed seats were aligned toward the stage. People were coming in single file and in groups, hundreds of them, and then thousands. As I walked among them, I heard the languages of France, England, Mexico, Austria, the Czech Republic. There were groups from West Africa, Germany, Poland, Scotland, Portugal, and Brazil. A Romanian chorus of middle-aged women began to sing softly in their seats. And when they finished, a choir from Poland, 30 young women and men, began to sing lustily. Suddenly, there was a rustling up front. Dozens of tall African women danced in. They were laughing and clapping in floor-length white cotton dresses. On the hems of the dresses were sewn the words, Archdiocese of Freetown, in Sierra Leone. They sat next to Catholic schoolchildren from Rwanda, who were clapping and shaking tambourines. I just looked at it all and I thought, the whole church is here. The room rocked. There was cheering here, drums there, an American spiritual being crooned somewhere way in the back. The choruses would pick up one another's sound so that a group from Santo Domingo would sing, and as they finished, a young male choir from Poland, they were in white tie and tails, would take up the song. And then as they finished, a group of Indians of the Americas, they were in native dress and full headdresses. They looked like beautiful peacocks. They would start to beat native drums. It was as if the disparate but unified members of the audience, as they echoed and supported one another, were a living symbol of the church every day in the world. And now something came alive on the stage. Two Swiss guards in their purple and orange uniforms, big red plumes on their black helmets, entered the stage and stood erect in the middle with halberds in their hands. Then a flurry of cardinals and bishops in black with red and purple sashes. Then two papal chamberlains in white tie and tails. So we all looked to the left of the stage. There was movement. It was him, the Pope. And he was 20 minutes early. The woman next to me, a regular audience goer, laughed. She said, "When he's ready these days." John Paul was rolled slowly onto the stage. He was seated in a brown wooden chair that rested within a kind of wooden rig on little wheels. It was like a wheel throne. It was like the kind of big wooden roller they used to get something off the top shelf at Home Depot. And it looked both practical and absurd. Everyone applauded, and as I clapped, I looked around me and saw faces set in a determinedly pleasant look, as if their hearts were saying, "I am so happy to see you, but the sight of you is breaking my heart." He was dressed all in white, bent forward in his chair, white surplice, white zucchetto, that's the skull cap popes wear, white gold fringed sash. As the wheel throne reached the center of the stage, the Pope was surrounded by a scrum of aides and cardinals. They helped him to his feet, helped transfer him to a white upholstered high-backed chair, and then they turned it toward us. He looked out at us, and we looked back at him. His face was, oh, his face. I thought of the little girl on his last trip to Canada a year before. She was a child, 6 years old or so, and she had it in her head that the Pope was the best person in the world. So her parents brought her to a big outdoor mass, and she was chosen to give him flowers. So she walked up to him with her bouquet, held it toward him, and he leaned his upper body toward her in his chair. And then she turned and ran, sobbing from the stage with what seemed to be panic. Because he was old, and his head was big, and his neck and back were curled, and the effort to lift his head so you could see his face drew his features down, and the Parkinsonian mask that froze his face made him look angry, or ill-meaning, or sad, and the poor child ran. Now the crowd took its feet, and the applause was continuous, but it was also muted. It wasn't full of joy as the crowd had been before the audience had begun. His cassock was too short, 6 inches off the floor. We could see his white cotton sports socks. We could see his worn brown shoes. He wears old loafers, like a working man, and not the traditional dainty slippers of a pope. "We love you, Papa," someone called out. "We love you, Holy Father." He lifted his head with effort. We took our seats. Suddenly, I realized the purpose of a Vatican announcement that had been issued the week before. The Holy Father, the press office said, would not go hiking in the hills this summer as he had in the past, but instead would work through his vacation writing a memoir of his early years as priest and bishop. The tourists all buzzed about this, how amazing that the old man would produce a book on his time off. What they didn't notice, what had been cleverly obscured by the announcement, was that the Pope's legs don't work anymore. Of course he wasn't going hiking. When I mentioned this later to a priest in Rome, he laughed. "John Paul," he said, "has grown sensitive about speculation regarding his illnesses, and he'd recently groused, half comically, to an American cardinal, 'You tell those American journalists the Pope doesn't run the church with his feet.'" The Pope read to us from remarks typed in white letter-sized paper. His voice was blurry and thick. The papers trembled in his hand. He spoke in Italian. The thin neck microphone into which he spoke was very sensitive. We could hear him breathe between the sentences. People in the audience became distracted. Then the Pope spoke in Polish, and his voice became stronger. And even though most of the people in the audience didn't understand what he was saying, they quieted and leaned forward. He had a pronounced tremor in his left arm, and during the translation he leaned his head and rested his chin on his left hand to stop the shaking. Then he cleared his throat and he spoke in English, but the only words I could make out were, quote, "the spirit of the Beatitudes." Later I read the Associated Press report of the Pope's message. He had spoken of Psalm 145, which he called a song of praise for the morning. It ends, he said, in a proclamation of the sovereignty of God over human history. And it reminds us, he said, that the Lord shall reign forever. School children from Santo Domingo cheered the old chant, "Juan Pablo II, te quiere todo el mundo." He raised his right hand to acknowledge the chants. The playfulness of the past, the way he used to wave with both hands up and down and say woo-woo to the children who cheered him in New York and Chicago so long ago, that was not possible for him anymore. And yet, as I watched him, I realized I did not see him as ill and frail. I saw him as encased, trapped in there, in an outer immobility. Outside he is old and frail, but inside he is John Paul, the one who had walked out on the Vatican balcony and dazzled the crowd 24 years before. And for the first time I thought, he